So turn then please to Ruth and chapter 4, and we're going to be considering verses 13 to 22. And this passage is then dominated by a birth. The birth itself is recorded, you'll notice, at the end of verse 13. She bore a son. And just in passing, before we go any deeper into this passage, that verse, verse 13, it reminds us of two points which in biblical terms are so basic we shouldn't even need to mention them, but which in fact are so contrary now to the thinking of our society that we perhaps do need to remind ourselves of them. Point number one, sex comes after marriage. Sex comes after marriage. That's very clear, isn't it, in the order of things here. So Boaz took Ruth and she became his wife and he went in to her, which is a standard Old Testament phrase there for sexual relations. Now this isn't simply Boaz and Ruth then conforming to the cultural norm of their day. No, this is Boaz and Ruth conforming to the timeless, culture-transcending definition of marriage that we have in the Garden of Eden itself. You know the words, Genesis chapter 2, verse 24. Therefore a man shall leave his father and his mother and hold fast to his wife, and they shall become one flesh. Now where does the becoming one flesh come in that sequence? Well, of course, it comes at the end, doesn't it? After the leaving of parents, after the holding fast of husband and wife in the actual act of marriage, it's after all of that that then there is the becoming one flesh. And so it's that timeless, culture-transcending formula of Genesis 2:24 that Boaz and Ruth are conforming their behavior to here. It may not be what we see when we watch the movies. It may not be what we see amongst our own friends and peers. But this is God's stipulation, of course, that sexual relations come after marriage. And like all God's stipulations, we need to remind ourselves, this one, of course, is for our good. The confining of sex to marriage is not only right, it is advantageous, it is healthy, it is enriching. God doesn't come up with arbitrary stipulations in his word. Every stipulation he gives is good. Every stipulation is for the good of his creatures. So that's one basic point. And then basic point number two, conception is from the Lord. Conception is from the Lord. That's clearly stated, isn't it? The Lord gave her conception. Now, this isn't then a pre-scientific description of something that we now know is merely a biological process. Yes, of course, we do now know much more about conception than the author of this book would have known. We can give a very comprehensive and satisfying biological account of it. But that does not for one moment invalidate this description of human conception. You see, the fact is that like a storm, like a harvest, like a solar eclipse, like the migration of birds halfway around the world, all these phenomena have two different levels of explanation, don't they? So there is an explanation which we might call the scientific mechanism, but then there is another explanation which we might call the ultimate agency. And so with human conception then, there is, yes, a scientific mechanism, but there is also then an ultimate agent, and that ultimate agent is God. And so it's not an either or. It's not that now we know the scientific mechanism very well, now we can dispense with the whole idea of the ultimate agent. It's not either or, it's both and. These are complementary descriptions of human conception. And this is important, of course, because if then conception is just a biological process and there's nothing more to be said about it than that, then you can have unfortunate conceptions, and you can have inconvenient conceptions, and you can have dispensable conceptions, and you can have terminable conceptions. But if in fact conception is God intricately, lovingly knitting together a person, as the psalmist puts it in Psalm 139, then deliberately undoing that, deliberately unraveling God's knitting project within the womb, is a monstrous thing. And using humane language of choice and women's rights and all the rest of it doesn't do anything to alter that. So those are just two basic points then, which it's perhaps worth reminding ourselves of because of their countercultural nature today. That sex comes after marriage and that conception is from the Lord. But our passage then, I'm saying, is dominated by a birth. And we need to ask the question, the birth then of whom? And I want to supply three answers to that question. First of all, a restorer. A restorer. This is how the child is described in verse 15 by the women of Bethlehem. He shall be to you a restorer. In the previous verse, he's actually described as a redeemer. The Lord has not left you this day without a redeemer, which seems a little bit confusing because, of course, up until now, Boaz has been the redeemer. But I think it's as simple as this, that Boaz, of course, is the official redeemer in our narrative. Because he then restores life to Elimelech in a legal, technical sense by perpetuating Elimelech's name on Elimelech's land. He is the redeemer, the official redeemer, in a legal and technical sense. This baby, he's a bit like a redeemer. That's the point of these women in Bethlehem. He's a bit like a redeemer because he restores life to Naomi in a psychological and emotional sense. He revives her spirits. That's basically what they're saying. He'll be a restorer of life, a nourisher of your old age. He will lift you. He will cheer you. He will hearten you. He will brighten your last years. That's what the women are saying. So a restorer of life, a redeemer, in that more informal sense, psychologically, emotionally, for Naomi. And I think there's a general level of application that we can explore here, application for grandchildren. If you have grandparents who are living, then don't just see them as an unceasing source of Christmas and birthday presents, but rather as those to whom you can be a blessing. Obed was going to be a blessing to his grandmother. His name means servant, one who serves. Possibly it's an abbreviation of Obadiah, servant of Yahweh, servant of the Lord. But the only form of service that is actually given any expression in the scriptures that this man was going to perform was toward his aged grandmother. He was going to restore her life, nourish her grey hairs. He was going to be a reviver of her spirits. And that's a great role then for you, if you're a grandchild with living grandparents. Perhaps your grandparents aren't Christians. And there's a real ministry that you can have there. I was talking to a friend just a couple of weeks ago, and his father died some 10 or 12 years ago. He was saying, I don't know for sure whether my father died a believer or not. But he said, if he did die a believer, I don't think it was so much anything I said to him as the impact of my children on him. My friend's father had had a fairly dysfunctional family life all his days. And yet these grandchildren of his had loved him and had treated him with such respect and such affection that my friend was saying, if he became a believer at all, it was probably through the witness of those loving, respectful, affectionate grandchildren. That can be your role if your grandparents aren't Christians, or perhaps you're privileged to have grandparents who are Christians. Well, still, you can perform a role, you can have a ministry to them, you can be a blessing to them. Just like Obed, you can revive their spirits. Old age is difficult. There are many things about it calculated to discourage. And you can be, like Obed, an encourager to your grandparents. It's a role that Obed was to perform and which perhaps more of us ought to think about this evening. But then perhaps we can go a bit further than that and apply it not just within our immediate families, but within the church family. I guess we can be rather obsessed, can't we, within our evangelical subculture with youth, youth ministries, youth workers, and all the rest of it. And yet there are many older saints within the Church of Jesus Christ who need ministering to. We don't have many paid ministers to that section of our evangelical churches. Older saints who are lonely, who are frustrated with their limitations, who are troubled by many thoughts of the past, who struggle in lots of different ways. And all of us then, not just those of us who are really young, but all of us can be Obeds, can't we, toward older saints within this church and older saints we know in other churches. Just chatting, perhaps, simple things, chatting after a service, paying a visit to their house or flat or old people's home, taking them out for a cup of coffee every now and again. There are so many ways in which we can be Obeds, reviving the spirits of literal grandparents, or just grandparents in the faith, grandparents in the Church of Jesus Christ. So there are applications of that kind, but let's go a little bit deeper here. Because you might think, well, okay, here are these women of Bethlehem, and they're getting excited here, and they're kind of using this very extravagant language about Obed's significance for Naomi. But at the end of the day, surely there are going to be limitations to this. Because Obed isn't actually Naomi's biological grandson at all, is he? And so yes, just because he's a child and he's going to bring kind of life and energy to the family, yes, in that general sense, he might be able to lift her spirits and revive her in her old age. But at the end of the day, he's not her biological grandson. People keep looking at Fraser and using this phrase, he's a little Dan. Poor old Fraser has been lumbered with that already in his young life. He's a little Dan. Well, Naomi was never going to look at Obed and say he's a little Marlon, because Obed had none of Marlon's genes, none of Marlon's blood running through him. He might be a little Ruth. He might bear some physical resemblances to his mother Ruth, but he's not going to be a little Marlon. But you see, these women, let's notice carefully what they're saying, these women of Bethlehem. They're not saying, well, okay, yes, but at least there is this small consolation. Okay, he might not be a little Marlon, but at least he is a little Ruth. At least he is kind of in your extended family in its new configuration, Naomi. They're not saying that, are they? They're saying, actually, this is even better. Having a child who is a little Ruth is even better, they're saying, than having a child who's a little Marlon. Because notice carefully the logic here. They say, he shall be a restorer of life and a nourisher of your old age, for, that's because your daughter-in-law who loves you, who is more to you than seven sons, has given birth to him. See what they're saying? They're saying, actually, having this child who is a little Ruth, who is from her, who has her resemblances written across his face, actually, that is better than having a little Mahlon. Because Ruth has been a brighter jewel in your life, Naomi, than Mahlon could ever have been. Or even than Mahlon and Chilion put together could ever have been. Or even could seven sons put together have been. This woman, she's extraordinary, they're saying. She has loved you, Naomi, with such a remarkable, unearthly kind of love. She clung to you on that road from Moab to Bethlehem when everything cried out, go home, go back to Moab. When you were crying out, go back to Moab. She clung to you and would not let you go. And then you arrived back in Bethlehem. And on day one, she served you by going out so diligently to the harvest fields early in the morning, stayed there all day, brought back food, did that day after day after day. When you came up with a scheme as to how she could indicate her availability for marriage to Boaz, she complied with that, absolutely. She has brought credit to you, Naomi, by gaining a reputation as a worthy woman in Bethlehem, chapter 3, verse 10. She has loved you, Naomi, with such an astonishing love. Apart from Yahweh himself, she is the greatest treasure of your life. Ruth is better than Mahlon, or Mahlon and Chilion, or seven sons could ever have been for you. And I guess it reminds us this evening, doesn't it, that we can so easily have a very rigid concept of what the blessed life looks like. I'm sure Naomi did as a young woman, that to be blessed by God meant getting married and having children, preferably lots of children, preferably sons, perhaps even seven sons. That was the path of blessing. That's what a blessed life looked like. And for Naomi then, they were God's greatest this lifely gifts. And the lack of them would mean being unblessed. There was no other way really to be really blessed by God than that path. And yet you see, here she is now. And she has no husband. And she has no sons. Because they've all died. And yet these women of Bethlehem are saying, Ruth, you are really blessed by God because you have this daughter-in-law. And no young woman were to set out in life aspiring to one day have a fantastic daughter-in-law. That wasn't what made them tick. But these women are saying, with this daughter-in-law, you are more blessed than a woman with seven sons. You see, sometimes we can overlook, can't we, God's greatest blessings in our lives, because we have this rigid concept of what the blessed life looks like. And we think being blessed by God means having this and this and this, and we don't have this and this and this. And we have a completely different set of circumstances. And so we're not blessed. And here's Naomi. And she has this thing that she never thought of as being a blessing. But actually, it's the richest treasure, the brightest jewel in her life. And we must be alert to those ways in which God perhaps lavishes us with the very best things. And even if they're not what we had envisaged, we need to recognize those as precious gifts that they are indeed from God. So, this child then, what is he? He's a restorer. Secondly, notice with me, he's a son. He's a son. Now that seems very obvious. He's a male child and therefore he's a son. He's Ruth's son. But it's not quite as simple as that, is it? Because according to our passage, he's whose son? He's Naomi's son. We've been talking about him so far in our sermon this evening as Naomi's grandson. And of course, generationally, that makes the most sense. But that's not how it's portrayed actually here in our passage. Obed is portrayed as Naomi's son. So let's just notice two or three things in that connection. First of all, the logic behind this. The logic behind this. So remember then that Boaz, he is a blend of a kinsman redeemer on the one hand and levier on the other hand. Remember we used that word, it's a Latin word meaning brother-in-law. And in Deuteronomy 25, we have all that leveret legislation, as it's known. I think in the heading in the ESV, it probably uses that word. And you remember then what that legislation is about. The lever was someone who produced children on behalf of his deceased brother. If his brother had died, he married the widow and had children on behalf of his deceased brother. Now, of course, strictly speaking, Boaz can't be a levy. He can't perform that role for Elimelech because he's not Elimelech's brother. But Boaz, it can be a kinsman redeemer because he is related. So he can't, strictly speaking, be a levy, but he can be a kinsman redeemer. And so we can't have kind of have this blend, this combination. Boaz is a kinsman redeemer who performs the role of the levier, and he marries Ruth and has children on behalf of Elimelech. And so Boaz's children are Elimelech's children. And if they are Elimelech's children, then by definition they are Naomi's children, because Naomi is Elimelech's widow. And so that's the logic then, legally speaking, technically speaking, that's the logic of how Obed is Naomi's son, because of this role that Boaz has performed. So the logic behind this, secondly, notice the emphasis on this, because it really is emphasized. We have that declaration that I've cited several times in this series in verse 17. It's almost the climax of the whole book, I think, where they name the child and they say, a son has been born to Naomi. A son has been born to Naomi. So we have that great declaration there. But more than that, I think it's at least arguable that Naomi here not only has the legal identity of Obed's mother, but even actually performs the role of Obed's mother. I think it's at least arguable that Boaz and Ruth, to some degree, perhaps a considerable degree, hand over this child to Naomi for her to bring up the child. That's intriguing phrase there in verse 16. Naomi took the child, laid him on her lap, and became his nurse. And that word that is used there, nurse, it really is used of a foster mother, someone who brings, or foster father, someone who brings up a child on behalf of someone else. It's used of Mordecai in Esther chapter 2 verse 7. Mordecai brought up Esther on behalf of Esther's natural parents who had died. And that's the same word that we have here. And of course there's also the strange kind of disappearance of Boaz and Ruth, isn't there? They've got married, they've conceived, they've had the child, and then they just seem to disappear. And they're not even there, it seems, at the naming ceremony. At least they're not mentioned in the naming ceremony. And so it is, as I say, at least arguable that Naomi does perform the role of Obed's mother. But in any case, there's clearly an emphasis on this, that this child is Naomi's son. So the logic behind it, the emphasis on it, but then notice the significance of this. The significance of this. It must be significant, mustn't it? If it's thus emphasized, it must be significant. And it seems to me then, and I've mentioned this before in this series, it seems to me that it's significant because we have here that biblical motif of the woman who cannot have a child having a child. You see, that's Naomi's situation, isn't it? Back in chapter 1, verse 5, Elimelech's died. Mahlon and Chilion have died. She's left with just two Moabite daughters-in-law. No prospect whatsoever of having children. And yet, you see, through God's work, God's work actually within Ruth, first of all, bringing her in chapter 1 to faith in himself, in Yahweh. And then his work not only within Ruth's heart, but his work in Ruth's intricate circumstances, causing her to step into the right field on day one, and then causing this romance to flourish and her to marry this kinsman redeemer. Through all these intricacies, God has brought about this miracle. It's not a miracle in the technical sense, but it's certainly highly, highly improbable. But God has brought it about that Naomi is in this position where the people of Bethlehem are saying a son has been born to her. And of course, when God does that in the Bible, when God gives a child to someone who cannot have a child, whether it's Sarah, or whether it's Hannah, or whether it's Elizabeth, or whether it's Mary, it's not just random, is it? It's not just God a bit bored with endlessly producing children the normal way, and so he does it in a strange way every now and again. No, it's because that child has a special destiny. Which brings us then to our third point this evening. This child is a restorer. This child is a son. But thirdly, this child is a name. This child is a name. Perhaps it's because these women of Bethlehem sense them, what I've just been saying. They sense that Naomi is, if not quite a miraculous, certainly a very improbable mother here. And they sense then what that might mean for the significance of this child that has been born. It's perhaps because of that that they pray as they do in verse 14. May his name be renowned. It's like we use this kind of phraseology, so-and-so is a big name in the world of professional tennis or something. And they're saying, may this child be a big name. Not in professional tennis, but in Israel. May this child be a big name in Israel. And that prayer then was answered. And this child, Obed, did become a name in Israel. How? Well, verses 17 to 22 tell us how, don't they? Because he became an ancestor of David. But you remember how we saw in chapter 1, verse 9, a prayer that was answered beyond anything that could have been envisaged when it was prayed. Naomi's prayer that her daughters-in-law would find rest in the house of her husband. And we said that in the relationship that subsequently develops between Ruth and Boaz, God was answering that prayer beyond anything Naomi could have envisaged when she prayed it. And I think we have another example of that here. These women of Bethlehem praying, may Obed, may he be a name in Israel. That prayer was not only answered, it was answered beyond what these women of Bethlehem could ever have envisaged. Because ultimately, Obed has become a name not only in Israel, but way, way beyond that. Nehemiah is a fairly famous biblical character, isn't he? He's never mentioned in the New Testament. Rebecca, fairly eminent biblical character, never mentioned in the New Testament. Esther, never mentioned in the New Testament. Ezekiel, never mentioned in the New Testament. Obed, he's mentioned in the New Testament. And not simply in Philemon or in some very obscure part of Revelation, but in Matthew's Gospel, no less. Matthew chapter 1. So whenever Matthew's Gospel is read or studied anywhere in the world, Obed is heard. His name is heard. Obed has become a name, not just in Israel, but wherever Matthew's Gospel has reached. How? Well, because he, of course, is an ancestor not just of David, but of Jesus. He became an ancestor of Jesus. In other words then, here in this story that we've been considering over these past few weeks, God is constructing piece by piece. He's adding another piece, another couple of pieces, a few more bits to the channel by which he is going to bring his Messiah into the world. And I just want to close reflecting on that for a couple of minutes. God here, throughout this story, is busily constructing the channel by which he will bring his Messiah into the world. And to reflect, first of all, on this, that he's constructing it in a context of sin. He's constructing that channel in a context of sin. Let's not forget the opening line of our book. In the days when the judges ruled. Now, that's not merely a chronological marker. You know how we use the phrase the 1960s. And whenever we say the 1960s, we don't just think a decade, do we? We think of the sexual revolution and we think of the rejection of authority. And that phrase then has moral connotations of a decidedly negative kind. And it's the same with that phrase in verse 1 of this book, in the days when the judges ruled. It's not just talking about a half millennium period in history. It's, we're to think of idolatry and sexual lawlessness and all the other evils that are documented in the book of Judges. The phrase has negative connotations of moral connotations of the most negative kind. And we know then, don't we, from the book of Judges, that God in his holiness frequently punished Israel during that period. And we know from the book of Judges that God in his grace, despite so much provocation, frequently lifted and removed that punishment through spectacular deliverances. That's why it's called the book of Judges, because of those savior figures God kept sending to deliver his people from the punishment that they deserved. But what we discover now in this next book of the Bible, what we discover now in the book of Ruth, is that God in his grace went even further. And during this period, despite so many provocations, was not merely frequently sending rescuers to deliver Israel from the mess they've gotten themselves into. But God in his grace throughout this period, this period of all periods, was actually constructing the channel by which he would bring the Saviour of the world into the world. Isn't that grace? For God, in those darkest of days, when his people are continually shaking their fist at him and bowing down to Baals and sacrificing their own children, in that period of all periods, that God is busily preparing the way for the Saviour to come. In a town called Bethlehem, he's busily constructing that channel. Why didn't he get an axe and smash the channel? Why should I bring a Saviour when people are treating me like this? Why should I be preparing the way for Jesus to come? For a people who are so ungrateful and so persistently stubborn. And yet no, throughout all this rebellion, all this iniquity, all this wickedness, God is building that channel by which Jesus will come and die on the cross of Calvary. What a gracious God we have. So on the one hand then, God is constructing this channel in a context of sin, but then on the other hand, he's constructing this channel in a context of ordinariness, isn't he? Ordinariness. I mean, at a literary level, the book of Ruth is a bit of a footnote, isn't it, really, to the book of Judges. I mean, the book of Judges is massive, and Ruth is just kind of tagged along at the end. And then in terms of content, I mean, Judges is so exciting. It's full of battles and pursuits and all the rest of it. full of fat men getting daggers plunged through their bellies. But here you have Ruth, and it's just about a harvest and a field and a couple of guys meeting each other in a field, and it's all very ordinary. And yet you see, amidst the ordinariness of it all, God is doing something of cosmic and eternal significance. John Piper makes this comment on it. He says, "Everything we do in obedience to God, no matter how small, is significant. It is part of a cosmic mosaic that God is painting to display the greatness of his power and wisdom to the world and to the principalities and powers in the heavenly places," Ephesians 3:10. And then this: "A deep satisfaction of the Christian life is that we are not given over to trifles. Serving a widowed mother-in-law, gleaning in a field, falling in love, having a baby. For the Christian, these things are all connected to eternity. They are part of something so much bigger than they seem." How about that for an incentive to get out of bed tomorrow morning and go to your ordinary place of work, or stay in your ordinary home, and get on with your ordinary business, because it's not pointless and inconsequential. Nothing is for the Christian doing it for the glory of God, or part of this cosmic mosaic. May God bless his word to us. Amen. Well, before we come to the Lord's table, we're going to sing the hymn that we sang after the service last Sunday morning, "Behold the Lamb." It's number